All right, welcome to Indie Media On Air. I'm Chris Burnett, and tonight I have two guests that are going to be joining me. The first is Chris Dixon, who is an activist, writer, and educator, and I also will be joined by Kevin Keating, the author of a recent article on Counterpunch entitled GI Resistance to the Vietnam War. But first, Chris Dixon. Chris Dixon is an activist, writer, and educator, received his PhD from the History of Consciousness program at the University of California, Santa Cruz. His writing has appeared in We Are Many, Reflections on Movement Strategy from Occupation to Liberation, Anarchist Studies, Clamor, The Earth First Journal, Left Turn, Social Movement Studies, and Upping the Ante. He has been involved in transformative social movements for more than two decades. His book is entitled Another Politics, Talking Across Today's Transformative Movements with an Introduction by Angela Davis. In fact, Chris is coming to Los Angeles this coming weekend to speak about his book. There'll be two events. One is on Saturday, November 22nd, from 7 to 9 p.m. at 977 Chungking Road in Chinatown, just north of downtown Los Angeles. And on Sunday, November 23rd, at the Last Bookstore in downtown at 6 p.m. That's at 453 South Spring Street on the ground floor. Chris Dixon, welcome back to Indie Media On Air.
Chris, it's great to be here with you.
Yeah. So, well, let's just start off tell our listeners, what do you mean by another politics, and what is a transformative movement?
Starting off with the big question. That's wonderful. So another politics is actually just a term that I use as a kind of a placeholder to talk about a set of politics and kind of activist practices that people are developing, I think, on the radical edges of a whole variety of movements that we've seen recently, including the Occupy movement, but also the movement against the prison industrial complex, and I think the really rising climate justice movement right now, among many others. And it's a way for me to talk about what I see as the convergence of a variety of movements and kind of anti-authoritarian, anti-capitalist, anti-oppression politics. And transformative movements is a term that I use to talk about movements, or at least the radical edges of movements, that are trying to actually go to the roots of these social problems and really try to fundamentally change the systems and institutions that rule our lives and really shape the society in which we live.
And maybe you can explain what the relationship is between what you call another politics and the Zapatistas and as well as anarchism.
For sure. Another politics is certainly a term that borrows a lot from the Zapatistas, the indigenous rebels in Chiapas, Mexico. They have really developed a whole vocabulary over the last few decades for talking about a politics that has a certain kind of openness to it in its revolutionary imagination. That's really about listening and dialogue and imagination rather than getting stuck on really fixed forms and endless certainties. And I take a lot of inspiration from that, and I actually took the term another politics partly from the Zapatistas by way of a collective in New York called the Another Politics Is Possible Collective, which really started to try and popularize this idea. So that's a little bit about where that comes from. And I think it's related to the anarchist political tradition, but I think anarchism is really just kind of one aspect of another politics. The way I understand it, actually, is that anarchism is a long-standing political tradition, not only in this country, but across the world, that's rooted in anti-capitalist politics from the end of the 19th century. And these days, it's really one radical strand, but there are many others that I think are just as important and have some affinities with anarchist politics, but come from other experiences. I mean, I'm talking in particular about anti-prison politics, sometimes called prison abolitionist politics, and I'm thinking also about women of color feminism that has developed over the last several decades. And I think there are many commonalities between these politics. There's also some important differences, but I do see aspects of them coming together in important ways.
So you're on a bit of a speaking tour, and I'm curious about the reaction is to your talks and your book and what kind of conversations you're getting into, and, you know, maybe give us a sense of what you'll be talking about this weekend in Los Angeles.
For sure. Yeah, I've been on a speaking tour now for almost 4 weeks. I started out in British Columbia, and I've been going southward, and I'm actually in Santa Cruz, California right now. So this is the, I think, 9th or 10th city. Conversations have been really fantastic, and they've been pretty varied. I mean, lots of different people are coming out, and it's clear that there are a lot of people, especially after the Occupy movement, who are hungry to talk about radical politics and where do we go from here in terms of movement building and continuing to try to move toward fundamentally changing the system we're in and building mass movements that are actually capable of doing that. So this weekend I expect to be talking about some of the recent movement histories that I see as coming in to these more recent politics, and also some of the big questions that I think are coming up in relation to these politics and in relation to our movement experiences of the last couple of decades. What came together in this book and what I try to share in the events is based on interviews that I did with long-term organizers across the United States and Canada, and this is really my attempt to reflect and distill much of the experience and insight that I think we've been gathering together as we've been fighting over the last little while, and also to really dig into what are some of the big questions that we face that are in many ways very unresolved in relation to things like strategy or building organizations or grappling with the very thorny ways in which power and oppression tend to crop up within movements and activist spaces.
Well, you know, one question I do want you to answer, we've got a few minutes left. When you talk about leadership, what are the important points to take away in terms of organizing?
So I think leadership is a really serious issue, particularly within movements that have some connection to anarchist politics or even just a kind of anti-authoritarian sensibility. I think an unfortunate thing that has happened in the last few decades is that many activist spaces have started to see leadership as an inherently bad and oppressive thing, and to basically try to organize in such a way that we say that we don't have any leaders, that there are no leaders, or that we're all leaders. But often what this ends up doing is actually creating or making it impossible for us to talk about the ways that leadership is always happening within groups and within movements. Even when we don't explicitly discuss it, it is happening. There are always groups of people who are taking initiative in certain ways, who are stepping into roles of responsibility that other people are looking toward, and are often guiding what happens, what directions groups take, and what happens within movements. And when we don't talk about that kind of leadership as it's happening, it is often being organized on the basis of experience, skills, confidence, and it's really no surprise that many of those things are associated with people who come from more privileged social backgrounds. And so I think it's crucial to talk about leadership in really explicit ways and think about how we can actually share those kinds of skills, develop experience and confidence so that more people can actually step up into taking on those kinds of roles and responsibilities and really take initiative and help collectively direct the ways in which our groups and our movements are going. And, I mean, I think this is part of a model, a longstanding model, actually, that, you know, I sometimes look to the more radical wing of the civil rights movement and people like Ella Baker and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and their whole conception of collective leadership, really building a basis for whole groups of people to step up and take on more. And I think that's what we should be doing.
Hmm. It reminds me of a little bit of Joe Freeman's feminist work, The Tyranny of Structurelessness, and some points that were brought up in that pamphlet. We should wrap this up pretty quick here, and I just want to remind listeners that you will be speaking Saturday, November 22nd, that's this coming Saturday, from 7 to 9 p.m. at 977 Chungking Road in Chinatown, which is just north of downtown Los Angeles, and also Sunday, November 23rd at the Last Bookstore in downtown, that's at 6 p.m., and it's located at 453 South Spring Street. Also, listeners can look up your name, Chris Dixon, and the title of your book, which is Another Politics, and you'll get a link to a much more in-depth description of the book. Some final thoughts, and how do you hope to engage with people if they came out this weekend?
Well, I'm really excited to talk to people and actually learn from people who come out. Part of what I've really been attempting to do through this speaking tour is not just come out and talk about things that I've learned, but try and create spaces where we can talk together about lessons that we've been learning through our activist and organizing work, and also to really frankly get into talking about some of the challenges and obstacles that are coming up as we are trying to change the world. Because I think often we talk a lot about what we hope to accomplish, but we often don't talk so much about what we're actually accomplishing and what we're actually coming up against. And I think we should get honest about what we're doing and at the same time get ambitious about what we want to try and achieve together. And so I'm hoping that some of these conversations can be collective conversations that really dig into some of the specificities of what's happening in LA in terms of organizing right now.
Well, Chris Dixon, thank you for joining me tonight on the show, and I look forward to meeting you and hearing your talk this weekend. It's been a pleasure.
Really good to be back on again. I look forward to meeting you as well.
All right. Take care, and we'll see you soon. Up next, Kevin Keating. All right.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Kevin, welcome to Indie Media On Air. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
All right. Well, you're the author of a recent article that, as I mentioned at the top of the show, that I read at counterpunch.org entitled GI Resistance to the Vietnam War, The Collapse of the Armed Forces. Now...
Sure. Thanks. The general point of my article is that Vietnam is now, it's almost 50 years ago. In the United States, we seem to largely be socially engineered out of having any kind of historical memory comparable to what people in other industrialized societies have. But one of the main points of my article is to detail the fact that a key role in the defeat of the owners and rulers of the United States in the war effort in Vietnam was played by a mass movement of resistance by enlisted people in the armed services. They played a leading role in making the war unwinnable for LBJ and for Nixon.
Well, you know, one of the things you write in the article is our rulers want us to forget what happened during the Vietnam War. And my question to you is, why do they want us to forget?
They want us to forget because they know they'll have to deploy the armed forces in an apparently endless series of wars, cleaning up the foreign policy shenanigans that Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan began in Afghanistan in the 1970s and 1980s, and they know they need a pliant populace, and they need a pliant and obedient armed forces to carry this out for them. And Vietnam sets a powerful precedent for the fact that we have an image of the armed forces as being a monolithic entity that people join because they join freely because they simply want to be in the armed forces. They're patriotic. They think like job skills or something like that. But that under the right circumstances, the armed forces, some of the most powerful armed forces in modern history, have been brought to collapse by mass social unrest, and that's part of what happened in Vietnam.
Well, yeah, and we should get into that because the you detail in the article, and just a quick aside, I do want to mention for those who have paid attention to the fact that a recent war resistor by the name of Thomas Young passed away, and his letter to Bush and Cheney is very insightful, and I actually recommend people check that out. But back to the point of Vietnam, one of the things that's very striking in the article is the amount of when we say resistance within the armed forces, I mean, we're talking about the fragging or killing of officers. We're talking about sabotage. We're talking about a mass refusal to participate in confrontations with the quote-unquote enemy. Maybe lay out exactly some of those examples to illustrate how serious this issue is.
Yeah, all of what you've outlined is true. Until about 1968, the desertion rate for U.S. troops in Vietnam was actually lower than it had been in Korea and in World War II. But by 1969, which is the period of after the Tet Offensive, which was a very bloody, it was technically a military defeat for the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese, but it was very bloody. American troops sustained a very high casualty rate, and by 1969, the desertion rate had increased fourfold, and it wasn't just limited to Southeast Asia. It was also happening among GIs stateside and stationed in Europe and stationed in other parts of Asia. And there were mass many refusals of different units, like the first even well thought of units like the 1st Air Cavalry and the 196th Light Infantry Brigade to go into combat. Soldiers would go on search and avoid missions where they'd intentionally skirt clashes with the Vietnamese. They would build huge bonfires, in effect letting the Vietnamese know, here we are, we're not moving against you, we're not going to cause you any grief. And fragging, or the assassination or wounding of strict or unpopular officers by enlisted people, took off in 1968 and 1969, and it became a kind of epidemic within the armed forces. There's an interesting article published in the Armed Forces Journal dated June 7, 1971, by a Marine colonel named Robert D. Heinel, Jr. Heinel was a veteran Marine combat commander, and he had over 27 years of experience in the Marine Corps. And Heinel wrote, among other things in this article, I'm quoting Heinel now, "By every conceivable indicator, our army that remains in Vietnam is in a state approaching collapse, with individual units avoiding or having refused combat, murdering their officers and non-commissioned officers." Heinel goes on to say, "Sedition, coupled with disaffection from within the ranks and externally fomented," this is a key point, "externally fomented with an audacity and intensity previously inconceivable, infests the armed services." Heinel talks about other things, too, about, he writes at a different point, "Bounties raised by common subscription in amounts running anywhere from $50 to $1,000 have been widely reported to be put on the heads of leaders who the privates and specialist fours want to rub out. Shortly after the costly assault on Hamburger Hill in mid-1969, a GI underground newspaper in Vietnam called GI Says publicly offered a $10,000 bounty for the killing of Lieutenant Colonel Weldon Honeycutt, the officer who ordered and led the attack." And Heinel says, at a later point in his article, "The Pentagon has now disclosed that fraggings in 1970, 209 killings of officers and non-coms by enlisted men, have more than doubled from those of the previous year, 96 killings. He also said at the time, word of the death of officers will bring cheers at troop movies or in bivouacs of certain units. The fraggings weren't the only way that enlisted people helped to sink the war effort. There was also sabotage. There were, by 1970, there were more than 300 underground GI newspapers that had names like Harass the Brass, Star Spangled Bummer, All Hands Abandoned Ship, and the unrest among enlisted people was a key part of what drove the U.S. to pull out of a ground war and begin to move over to an air war strategy around 1970. Mm-hmm. And as the United States moved into an air war strategy, the wave of revolt began to be more pronounced inside the Navy. Aircraft carriers, like, let's see, which ones? The one called the USS Anderson was sabotaged. The USS Constellation was nearly lost at sea to a full-fledged mutiny. That would have been the first time that an American naval ship has been taken over by enlisted people in revolt. The aircraft carrier, the USS Ranger, was put out of commission by sabotage in late July of 1972. In fact, in the Ranger, the Kitty Hawk, and the Constellation, they're all aircraft carriers. They're referred to as super carriers. These are the largest battleships that have ever been, or the largest warships that have ever been built. And in the case of the USS Ranger, this aircraft carrier was subject to two dozen major acts of sabotage in a six-month period from June to October of 1972.
Hmm. So, you know, we've got about 8 minutes left, and I have two important questions I want to ask you. And the first one has to do with understanding who was in the military at that time and who's in it today, and what are the similarities or differences. You write, "Working class blacks and Latinos served in combat units out of all proportion to their numbers in American society, and major urban riots in Watts, Detroit, and Newark had an explosive effect on the consciousness of these men." That doesn't sound much different than today.
No, it doesn't. People will attempt to distinguish between the U.S. military of the second decade of the 21st century and the military of the Vietnam War era by saying, "Oh, well, back then there was a draft, and that was, people got dragged into the military, and they didn't want to go there, and that was why they were more inclined to resist or to try to get out of serving." But today we have a poverty draft where people are conscripted by the lack of opportunities in American society. And that poverty path falls inordinately on it's a burden. It's one of many burdens inordinately faced by predominantly non-white, working class and low-income youth.
No doubt.
I'm sorry. Say that again.
Yeah, I agree. Continue. Well, hey, listen. This is actually the next question I want to ask you, and let's just go into this. And it's one of the issues is over, obviously, because this might be new information for a lot of people. There was a documentary made called Sir No Sir, which I highly recommend. It actually touches on a lot of this, but it's one of the most important points to understand about the anti-war movement during that period, and maybe there are lessons today. And so that narrative or that story is something that is actually and there's a battle for that story in a sense. And you write, and I think this is an important point, and I want you to pick up on this point. You write, some years ago in a deceitful article in Mother Jones magazine, corporate liberal historian Todd Gitlin claimed that the peaceful and legal aspects of the 60s U.S. anti-war movement had been the most successful opposition to a war in history. You write, Gitlin was dead wrong. As a bourgeois historian, Gitlin is paid to render service unto capital by getting it wrong, and get it wrong he does again and again. So so you would argue that the most effective anti-war movement in history is what?
It was the collapse of the Russian and German armies and the wave of revolutions that swept Europe at the end of World War One. In fact, that helped bring about the end of World War One. That's a point like that plays directly into the situation we face in the contemporary United States. The United States is a very stable society. It's been a very stable society for a long time, but it's a society with tremendous structural inequality, with ever accelerating regime of repression and police violence, and a foreign policy that's based around an endless series of foreign wars. A society like the United States cannot remain stable indefinitely. You can't have a large, stable bourgeois democracy that doesn't have a very large, very content middle class. We no longer have that in the United States. One of the main roles of the armed forces is not simply to carry out acts of violence overseas. The owners and rulers of the United States are also preparing for domestic use of the armed forces. There was an operation called Urban Warrior carried out in Oakland, California in March 1999 involving 6,000 Marines and 700 sailors. It was largely carried out at the Alameda Naval Air Station, but also at a couple of abandoned former public housing projects in Oakland. It was welcomed by the always repugnant then mayor of Oakland, Jerry Brown. And part of their excuse for doing it was, well, this is like we're going to reproduce the conditions that were difficult when we staged your intervention in Somalia in 91 and 92. But it's clear that the owners and rulers of the United States are very, very afraid of the people who they own and who they lord it over and who they exploit. And they know that the game they're running is not necessarily going to be stable indefinitely, and that they need to prepare to use the armed forces domestically as well as overseas.
Right, and that brings
me. We need to be prepared for that as well.
That's my next question. And what do you mean by being prepared in when thinking about the armed forces? You actually outline a few questions that I think are relevant. One of them being, how do you deal with an army or navy to advance the level of conscience, organize an ongoing resistance?
Well, I think part of the reason that unrest spread in the American armed forces during the Vietnam War period is that there was widespread domestic opposition to the war. There was also widespread discontent with the fact that the strictly peaceful, within the law, strategy of conventional civil rights leaders had reached an effective dead end. American society was beginning to reach a breaking point. Social struggles and social upheavals that take place in civilian society tend to bleed into the ranks of the military. And if we examine recently Egypt, there was a very powerful regime, the Mubarak dictatorship. It was the second most heavily subsidized foreign policy ally of the U.S. in the world after Israel. A mass convulsive movement broke out, and when people in that movement started saying, look at the army, the army is against Mubarak, the army is on the side of the people, it was clear that their movement was doomed. any social movement that places any kind of faith in the legitimate structures of capitalist society is not going to be able to go forward and is ultimately going to defeat itself. The armed forces are essentially they're the first and the last bastion of the power of the people who own and rule capitalist America. And the armed forces are overwhelmingly populated by low-income and working-class people, people who don't go in because they're loyal to Bush or Cheney or to the Democrats or to the Republicans or to Wall Street, but because they have no better opportunities. And the same social forces that drive people to join the military are the kind of things that can turn people's minds around and get people to see that this social order offers us no future. It's bad news, and we should replace it with a society, an egalitarian, free society that's worthy of the human beings who live in it. And I'm surprised that, given the leading role played in the defeat of the United States by enlisted people in the armed forces, I'm surprised that in all the successive anti-war movements that have emerged in the United States since then, there's been no effort to reproduce the efforts that people engaged in the late 60s and the late 70s to fraternize with enlisted people, to say, we're on the same side as you, we all have the same goal, your goal is not to get killed and not to get brutalized and not to harm other people and to make sure that this thing that our rulers are doing to you doesn't happen to you. That's the kind of thing we need to learn from the more combative aspects of the anti-war movement. They engaged in, as Colonel Heinel noted in his article, a sustained effort to fraternize with enlisted people and undercut their willingness to act in the interests of the owners and rulers of America. We need to be doing that now. We need to do that tomorrow and next week.
Well, I'm afraid that we've run out of time, Kevin, and I want to thank you for joining me on the show. Do you have anywhere that people can reach you, or a website, or any information you'd like to share?
I have a web page. You have to Google it. It's called Love and Treason. Unfortunately, there's a really terrible right-wing made-for-TV spy movie that has the same name, but I'm sure my webpage had the name first. But anyway, you can Google Love and Treason. And also, for a more thorough examination of the role that enlisted people played in defeating the U.S. war effort in Vietnam, I highly recommend a book called Soldiers in Revolt by David Courtwright. Soldiers in Revolt was the basis for my article.
Okay.
I'm not crazy about recommending the use of Amazon for anything, but Amazon has Courtwright's book.
Okay. We're going to have to wrap it up. I'm really sorry to interrupt you there, but it's Soldiers in Revolt, The American Military Today by David Courtwright. Thanks again, Kevin.
Bye.
Bye. All right, this is Indie Media On Air. Thanks for listening. I'm Chris Burnett. We'll be back next week.
Informativo Pacifica.
A continuación, Informativo Pacifica.
No te la pierdas.
Because we are the 99%.
Hay muchos muertos más. Y a ellos no les han dado ni justicia, no les han hecho caso. Y nosotros, fíjense que se prendió esa mechita por nuestros hijos. Y para que la gente se diera cuenta...